you're here for something else, please step out now. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator, George Boyer. George Boyer is a professor of economics and industrial and labor relations. He's been at Cornell since 1982. He is an economic historian whose research examines social welfare policy, labor markets, and globalization in the 19th and early 20th centuries. He currently is working on a book manuscript entitled The Winding Road to the Welfare State: Economic Insecurity, Social Welfare Policy, and Living Standards in Great Britain, 1840 to 1940. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Boyer, who will introduce our other speakers.
Thank you. I'm going to begin just by saying a couple words about the new economics department, and then I'll introduce our speakers. The economics department is, in a sense, a new department that was formed 2 years ago by merging two former economics departments on campus. The Department of Economics in the College of Arts and Sciences that Ted and Jim were from, and the Department of Labor Economics within the School of Industrial Labor Relations that I come from. It's now one department making decisions as a single group that reports to two deans. Our faculty is now about 50 members. We have about 750 undergraduates, over 100 PhD students, and we service more than 5,500 students each year. The rationale behind the merger was to create an institutional structure that would permit a dramatic increase in the quality and visibility of Cornell economics. Our goal is to make the new department a top 10 economics department and to provide the best undergraduate economics education in the Ivy League. Toward that end, the department currently is engaged in an ambitious fundraising campaign with great support from the university. Thank you, those of you who are here. Our chair, Kevin Halleck, has been on endless road trips this year. He's always interested in talking with alums about the future of the department and unfortunately about the Red Sox. He's traveled so much that he has actually earned frequent flyer miles. He's earned a trip to the moon. Unfortunately, he still has to keep traveling so we can get back. Frequent flyer things are weird. It's one way. We also have begun a massive faculty recruiting effort that we expect to last for several years, and we've already had some great successes. And we have devoted significant effort to reviewing our undergraduate program and identifying ways to improve. In March of 2013, recently, we announced a new and improved undergraduate economics major that will replace our existing program. The new curriculum will first apply to incoming freshmen this fall. A number of additional improvements are on our agenda for the upcoming year, including building a new undergraduate lounge and study space, hiring a new student experience coordinator who will help with advising, research experience, and the like. And Ted O'Donohue, who has been leading this effort, is one of our speakers today. If you'd like to hear more about it, I'm sure he'd be willing to talk to you after the session. But enough about the department. Today we're here to learn about some of the research being done by two of our faculty members. I'm going to introduce both Ted and Jim. And then they'll speak in that order. You can tell, by the way, how long we've been here by the color of our hair. I'm not saying that you, as undergraduates, did this to me, but it's possible. Ted O'Donohue is a professor in the Department of Economics and has been at Cornell since 1997. His specialty is behavioral economics, and he is one of the leaders of the generation of behavioral economists who helped bring the research into mainstream economics in the late 1990s and early 2000s. He is a member of the Russell Sage Foundation's Behavioral Economics Roundtable. He was the team leader for the Cornell Institute for Social Sciences theme project entitled Judgment, Decision Making, and Social Behavior. He co-founded and co-organizes the top annual meeting of behavioral economists in the country. Starting on July 1st, he'll be the associate chair of the Department of Economics. James Berry is an assistant professor in the Department of Economics. His research addresses questions in development economics often touching on themes from behavioral and labor economics. He studies poverty in Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and South Asia. He is currently conducting several field experiments to study household subjective value of education and household decisions to purchase and utilize health products and educational services. So Ted will speak first, and then Jim.
Thanks, George, and thanks to all of you for coming. Very excited to see so many people interested in this topic. I actually teach behavioral economics in this room frequently. Never seen this many people in my class. So the plan is that I'm going to talk for about 15 to 20 minutes about behavioral economics, and then Jim will talk for about 15 to 20 minutes about development economics, and then we'll have lots of time for questions at the end, hopefully. So behavioral economics and development economics are two prominent fields in modern economics, also two fields where Cornell's played a major role in the history of these fields. I think one of the things you'll get a sense as you hear me and then Jim talk is these are two fields that really ought to be talking to each other a lot, and it's only recently have they been starting to talk to each other. One of the things that Jim and I are hoping to do in the years to come is to really use our sort of joint expertise at Cornell to bring these fields together. But our talks are going to focus a bit more on what each of us have been doing. So let me talk about behavioral economics, and let me just start with just giving you a sense of what behavioral economics is, what it's all about. So this is from the description of the program. Behavioral economics uses insights from psychology to better understand and improve economic outcomes. So I want to parse this for you. And actually, the way I want to get there is actually first just being clear on what is the science of economics. How do we think about economics? So two main pieces that I want to put forward in terms of the science of economics. The first is just to be clear that economists have two separate goals, and we always try to be very clear which goal we're thinking about when we talk. So one goal is to try to understand the economic outcomes that we observe in the world. A second goal is once we understand, then we can try to design policies to improve the economic outcomes that we observe in the world. So much of what we do is the first, but in some sense our big picture goal is the second. In terms of the first goal, what's the methodology that we use in economics? Well, it's a big back and forth between observing data and then developing theories, and observing data and developing theories. So we start by observing some economic outcomes. Then we try to develop a theory from what might explain those economic outcomes. Okay. Once we've done that, we can't go back to the original data, because showing the theory explains the original data just says we're good modelers. Doesn't say sort of anything more than that. So what we need to do is to develop additional or ancillary predictions of our model, and then go to the data to test those ancillary predictions. Inevitably, we go back to the data, we identify flaws in the initial theory, we then develop a new modified theory, or perhaps we jettison the first theory and come up with a completely new theory that performs better, then we go back to the data, so on and so forth. And that's sort of the science of how economics proceeds. So why am I bringing this up here? Well, behavioral economics is really just doing economics. Okay? So it's going to use the exact same goals, exact same methodology, with one new wrinkle. Traditionally in economics, there's been a set of assumptions that had to be part of any theory you write down. And in some sense, what behavioral economics is doing is saying, look, in fact, we can relax those, we can play with those assumptions as well as we develop our theories. So to give you a sense, so now moving to the science of behavioral economics, here are some standard assumptions that traditionally had to be part of any theory you write down. So perhaps the most famous that you all know is the assumption of pure self-interest, that people care only about themselves. Okay. But there's a bunch of others. So another standard assumption is that people treat gains and losses symmetrically. Winning $100, losing $100 feels roughly the same in terms of magnitude. Okay. People behave exactly as they plan. So economic models say you sit down, you form a plan for your life. Might be a conditional plan, depending, you know, you could have a plan to behave differently if it's sunny versus rainy, but whatever your plan is, you carry it out. Okay. People understand probabilities perfectly. Lots of problems there. And finally, assumption that people behave in their own best interest. Whatever people do has to be in their own best interest. The starting point for behavioral economics is to say, in fact, if you go to evidence from psychology, and then some evidence from economists that came in later that built on that evidence, it casts doubt on all of those standard assumptions as well as additional standard assumptions. Okay. Now I want to highlight here this starting point. This is really the easy part. It's sort of easy to show that those standard assumptions aren't quite right. Amazingly, economists were incredibly resistant to this, so it actually took people like Dick Thaler, Bob Frank, both here at Cornell in the 1980s, taking 10 or 15 years of going around and generating anecdotes or little bits of evidence to convince economists that those assumptions perhaps we should relax. Finally, by the 1990s, economists were convinced. And then the hard work began, the sort of hard work getting to the more the science of behavioral economics, where sort of my career started, is now, once we have this evidence from psychology, now we want to go back to this methodology of economics. We want to try to build better models based on that evidence from psychology. Okay, that is models that help us better understand economic outcomes and models that help us improve economic outcomes. So to illustrate this, let me give an example of some work from my own research history. And this is a phenomenon that's known as present bias, okay, in the behavioral economics literature. So what do we mean by present bias? So evidence from psychology suggests that people have a sort of bias for now. They always sort of relative to sort of thinking about their lives, they put a little extra weight on now relative to the rest of their lives. Okay? And of course, now is changing because tomorrow will be now. Okay? So let me give you this sort of phenomenon of present bias. Even if it's relatively small, it can have big implications. So let me illustrate this with a simple example. So suppose you receive an email, and this email says, click this link to take a 15-minute survey, and if you complete this survey, we'll send you a check for $100. Okay, sorry, if you complete the survey today, we'll send you a check for $100. Okay? Seems like a good thing to be doing. If that were the full stop, probably a lot of people would do this. Okay? But suppose the email goes on to say that if you complete the survey tomorrow, we'll send you $95. And if you complete the survey in 2 days, we'll send you $90, and so on and so forth. Okay? So just to sort of set this up as an example, suppose you feel it's well worth 15 minutes to earn $100, spending 15 minutes on a survey to earning $100. Indeed, you might feel it's well worth spending 15 minutes to earn even $40. Okay, so if this is something you plan to do. Okay, but it could also easily be that today you decide the best plan is you don't want to do that 15 minutes right now. You'd rather do it in the future. So the best plan is I'm not going to do it today. I'm going to do it tomorrow. And yeah, I get $5 less, but that's worth it. So I don't have to do this sort of pain of 15 minutes today. Okay, so today I wait, planning to do this survey tomorrow. Now the problem arrives because tomorrow, now is now. Okay, so tomorrow arrives, you change your mind. Now you decide you don't want to spend the 15 minutes now, you'd rather spend it tomorrow, a $5 sort of cost of doing that. Again, you decide it's okay. So you wait again, planning to do it the second day. Okay, and hopefully you can see what's going to happen here. Then the next day arrives, now that day's now. So you change your mind again, and this can continue until you end up never completing the survey. Okay. So clearly a stylized example. You can imagine lots of other stuff that might come in, but it's just meant to illustrate this basic idea of present bias and the types of problems that can emerge. Okay. So just to be clear about this, the standard model, again, would assume, the standard economic model would assume that people have to behave as planned. So if I go back to this sort of suppose you feel it's well worth, well, sorry, this line here, where today you feel the best plan is to complete the survey tomorrow, there's nothing wrong with that according to the standard model. But the standard model would say when tomorrow arrives, you have to carry out that plan. This evidence of present bias, though, suggests, no, maybe people don't do that. Okay, maybe they change their mind again and again and again. Okay. So in fact, so this is a simple example, actually related to some stuff I did sort of 15 years ago. This idea has been applied by myself and a lot of other behavioral economists to a lot of economic applications, this sort of incremental procrastination type intuition. Just to give you some examples, one example where some very nice work has been done is procrastination and going to the gym. So that is people sort of planning to go to the gym. You're sitting on the couch, or you're sort of planning to go to the gym tomorrow, but when tomorrow arrives, you're sitting on the couch, you say, yeah, I'd rather go the next day. Okay. In fact, this research also has nice evidence of procrastination and canceling gym memberships. So they have a panel data set of people, and what they see is a big chunk of people who eventually stop using the gym and eventually cancel. And in that group of people that eventually stop using the gym and canceling, there's actually 2.29 months of continuing to pay their gym membership without ever using the gym, okay, before canceling. Another nice example, not exactly procrastination, but the same sort of incremental logic, is addiction. Okay? Standard economic model, this behaving as planned, what this says is people that end up with a cigarette addiction, for instance, according to the standard model, that would have to mean they decided, I'm going to be a cigarette addict. okay? Or at least probabilistically decided, you know, I'm going to start smoking and there's a 50% chance I'm going to be a cigarette addict, okay? You have to plan on that. This sort of incremental present bias intuition, though, suggests an alternative story, which is when people are young or with friends, maybe they decide they're going to smoke cigarettes for the next week or the next month, okay? But then as time passes, you have these sort of incremental decisions to smoke a little bit longer or to smoke a little bit more per day or per week, and then they just end up with an unplanned addiction. Seems in some sense like a more natural explanation for many addictions. Another example I'll say less about, but there's evidence out there of procrastination in job search, that people sort of taking time to find a job, not because they can't find a job, but because they sort of, you know, don't search enough from day to day. And then perhaps the sort of most important example where this has been applied very successfully is procrastination in saving behavior. So that is, people want to save more, they plan to save more, but they keep sort of putting off starting that saving. And indeed, some very nice research by Dick Thaler and Shlomo Bernardzi, where they actually generate a plan that many firms have implemented to help overcome this problem that they trademarked, called the Save More Tomorrow Plan. And essentially what they did is they offered employees the option to start increasing their savings via automatic deductions starting in a month or two. Okay? And indeed, lots of employees took that up, and it was very successful. Okay? So again, sort of examples of successfully applying these ideas. Okay. So let me move on to talk about a little bit more research, a slightly different flavor. And how I want to get there is I want to just highlight that within sort of behavioral economics, there are two types of research, two types of approaches to research. One type of approach, which the research I've discussed to this point sort of falls into, is you take an idea from psychology, like this idea of present bias, you develop its predictions in various economic applications, and then you go look for evidence. Okay, so take present bias, develop the implications for addiction, go look for evidence. Take present bias, develop the implications for savings, go look for evidence. An alternative approach that's sometimes used is to go sort of the opposite direction. That is to go out in the world, look for economic outcomes that seem odd from the perspective of those standard economic assumptions that I said before. Behavior that's hard to explain with the sort of approach we usually use in economics. And then try to investigate whether insights from psychology can help us understand those behaviors. So let me give you another type of research that sort of illustrates this. This is more preliminary research, something I'm working on right now with a former Cornell grad student that's actually in the context of development. So this will make a nice transition to Jim. So actually what this research is about is bulk discounts in Tanzania. So in fact, looking at the data, our sort of first step was seeing in Tanzania, households face significant bulk discounts. But I want to be clear here, this is not the type of bulk discounts that you think about in the US. So this isn't sort of going to Costco and loading up with toilet paper, things like this and whatnot. This is very small bulk discounts. So to give a few examples here, this is something like choosing to buy one onion for 50 Tanzanian shillings versus four onions for 100 Tanzanian shillings, sort of very small quantities. Buying a little label, which is about 3 tablespoons of cooking oil, often put in a little plastic baggie to take it home, versus buy a half liter for 1,000 Tanzanian shillings. If you're not good at this translation, I did it online, half a liter is about 33 tablespoons. So about 11 of these will get you up to a half liter. Okay? Similar thing for kerosene, buying the little ladle of kerosene versus a half liter of kerosene. Or for charcoal, buying, I'm not quite sure how it ends up being 0.36, but buying this sort of small quantity for 200 shillings versus four times that for 300 shillings. I mean, these are actually examples that we're seeing for some households facing. So roughly speaking, I mean, these are sort of anecdotal, there's variation in the data, but roughly speaking, these are decisions of purchase every day for today's usage versus purchase every week for the week's usage. Okay? So the next step we did after identifying this stuff is we actually went out, and this is where we're sort of where we are right now, and try to quantify to what extent are households taking advantage of these bulk discounts, and if they're not, how much are they losing out in terms of money? Okay, and in fact, they're losing out. Sort of households are not taking advantage of it for the large part, and they're losing out quite a lot. So in fact, on average, households are losing something like 20 to 40% of money, or spending 20 to 40% more than they need to for these goods. And this is big, so we've done a sort of very preliminary calculation, sort of back of the envelope. But for the households in our data set, 8% of those households, if they just rearranged their consumption purchases, would move from below the poverty line to above the poverty line. So, I mean, this is like big stuff, and yet they're not doing it, okay? So the question comes up, why? And this is sort of where we are now at the sort of investigation stage. So we're sort of going through, we're sort of laying out a list of possible things that might explain this. There's sort of two standard stories that you could think about. You know, maybe this has something to do with transportation costs, it's heavy to carry stuff home, or storage costs at home. Maybe it has something to do with cash or credit constraints, that you don't have enough money to sort of buy at the weekly level, you need to buy every day. Our initial best guess, but we still need to do more work, is that these are not going to play a major role here, because again, these are very small quantities and very frequent purchases. When we typically talk about these things, we talk about larger quantities and less frequent purchases. So we're also trying to explore possible behavioral explanations, things like inattention or not really understanding just how much they could save if they bought things in different patterns. Or maybe that it just requires too much effort to manage your inventories if you try to sort of buy at the weekly level. And then perhaps the most interesting, and again, we're trying to see to what extent they might play, one is present bias. Maybe you're afraid that if you buy at the weekly level, you'll bring the stuff home and you'll consume it in 2 or 3 days. Okay, and you end up consuming a lot more than you intended to. Or then a second thing, which is consuming more quickly than intended, but for a different reason. Maybe you're afraid if you bring home the weekly amount and the neighbors see it sitting on the shelf, the neighbors are going to be knocking on the door quite frequently asking if they can borrow something. Okay. So as I said, this is preliminary. No clear answers yet. We're working on it. Check back in a year from now. So on that note, let me turn it over to Jim. So.
I'm real excited to be here. So I'm going to be talking about development economics and specifically kind of the type of work that I do to kind of just frame a little bit what development economics is and to kind of basically take what Ted's definition generally of what economics is. It's to understand the economic conditions and behavior of poor households and firms in developing countries. So we just focus on the set of developing countries, which is actually most of the countries in the world. And specifically, we want to use economic analysis to inform policy to alleviate poverty. I'm going to take a slightly modified version of the way Ted sort of defined economics, and there's actually some feedbacks, and especially in development economics, and we do a lot of policy evaluation, and we do policy evaluation to understand behavior and evaluate policy. And I'll show you a little bit more about what I mean by that in a minute with an example of some work that I'm doing. Okay? So just to... Oops. Uh-oh. Well, is it frozen? Okay. So just to kind of drill down, and the kind of work that I do is to really take some specific issues... Take specific issues in developing countries and try to understand them from an economics perspective and to kind of inform policy and evaluate different policies to kind of help with these certain issues. So one of the things I work on quite a bit is education, right? So we know, just looking at the data, that developing households in developing countries have worse education outcomes. So you know, you have a great deal of sort of dropout after the primary level of education. There's you know, it's this big issue of trying to keep kids in school after basically primary school. And in terms of learning, it's, you know, think about kind of teaching basic reading and math skills to kids is a big challenge in developing countries. We know this. But, you know, how do households really make education decisions? And so how do households, given the resources that they have, actually make decisions to educate their kids or not? This is something that we actually don't know a ton about. And so, you know, One of the things I'm working on is trying to understand whether the households undervalue education, whether the actual benefits to education are actually perceived by households. Maybe they lack access to quality education. And if that's true, how can they be encouraged to motivate their children to learn? Or if there's some kind of economic failure there, how do we fix that? Okay. And then, you know, we have the household side, but there's also kind of the provider side of understanding education systems and how education systems might contribute to outcomes. So along with poor education outcomes, we have obviously very lousy systems in a lot of countries. And so we want to understand how the inputs are insufficient. So what are the inputs that actually produce a quality education in developing countries and how can they be improved? Okay, now it works again. All right. So you can basically go through the same logic for health. okay? I also work on some stuff in health. And so again, we know in developing countries, households in general have worse health outcomes, so in terms of things like life expectancy, child mortality, general morbidity, some maternal mortality. So those are all lower, obviously, in developing countries. But you know, understanding kind of the economics and understanding how households make health decisions is something that, again, we don't know enough about. So is it just that, you know, how first we want to just know how much they demand goods and services? Like, do they, is it just lack of access and they would actually buy things if it was provided to them or if they had access to them? Do they lack information about things? They know that their health is poor, but they have no idea how to improve it. Do they lack the means to pay? Is it just a virtue of being poor? And so that all these things kind of suggest different policies. Okay? And then again, from the provider side, you know, we also have poor health systems in developing countries. So there might be certain types of access that aren't there. So what are the inputs and the type of access that will actually provide a health system that's sort of functional and useful to people? And you know, how can these things be improved from where they are? Okay? So this is very broad, right? So this is just kind of how do we think about just generally these kinds of issues, and obviously there are many, many more that development economists think about. So just drilling down. Oh, I'm not going to show you the picture yet. Okay. So one of the issues in education is that you have, you know, poor education outcomes in among kids, but you know, the household, if you look at the sort of education inputs that are being provided by the household, those are also very poor. So the households don't have books. I'm thinking in particular about India, because I did a study in India, which I'm going to tell you about in a second. So the households don't have many books. They don't have other kinds of education assets. The parents are very poorly educated. So there are a lot of areas where the median level of education among parents is zero. So parents have never been to school. So one of the policies that people have suggested here is to educate the parents. Okay? And so one of the policies that I've just finished evaluating is an adult literacy evaluation for mothers. So one of the nice things about being a development economist is I get to go to developing countries and take pictures and then show them to people. So this is a picture of a women's literacy class in India. Okay? And so we evaluated this program, one, to see if it's a useful program in terms of educating women, but we want to use it to kind of understand how we can influence the household education production, so that how can we influence the education of the kids. Okay? So the questions that we were asking is, do these women's literacy classes teach women? That's the kind of the main policy questions. Does it empower women? Okay, which is also a kind of a big issue in development. Does it encourage child learning, and does it improve the home learning environment for example, by encouraging mothers to be more involved with child learning, or maybe to get more education materials in the home, et cetera? Okay? So what we did, and a lot of the kind of methods that I use in my research, is conduct a field experiment. So we assigned villages to receive mother literacy classes or not. So half the villages in our study received these classes, and the other half didn't. It was randomly assigned. So we compare the two groups, and that gives us the causal effect of these classes. Okay? So what's the answer? Well, all these things were actually affected by the classes. Okay? They were affected not a huge amount, but a statistically detectable amount. Okay? All these things show improvements. One of the reasons why the effects are small is because it's extremely challenging to get women to attend these classes. Okay? And so what we're kind of showing is that if you are able to get these classes to work, like to get women to come, then you can sort of open up a whole bunch of possible inputs that might go into child education within the household. Okay? Exactly how this works is something that we're working on, and we're kind of trying to use our experiment to tease out all these mechanisms and understand a little bit more about how households make education decisions. Okay? So here's another study. This is way more in progress, something I just started. So thinking about private schooling. So private schooling, so public schooling in developing countries is usually free. It's usually kids have a lot of access to it. There's been a lot of money spent to give kids access, especially at the primary level, to schooling. But it's usually very poor quality. Okay? So what, as a reaction to that, a lot of households in developing countries have turned to the private market. Okay? And there are basically two channels for this. One is going to a private school, very cheap private schools. So not like a real fancy private school, but such as a $3 or $4 a month level of private school. Okay? And the other is to go to classes after school and pay for them. Okay? So in this research, and the thing that we're trying to pick apart is that nobody really understands this market. This is something that's come up in the last maybe 5 years or so, and it's something we don't really understand how households, you know, given that they're relatively poor in means, and all the policy energy has gone into getting these households access to public schools, but you know, households are still going and purchasing education for their kids anyway, even though they're very poor. Okay? So we want to know first, very simply, what types of households demand these classes? Are they just more wealthy than the other households around? Or is it something else? Okay? And another is this kind of more interesting, I think, question that kind of starts to touch on behavioral economics, that we see in the organization that we're working with, as they've sort of started raising their fees, they've noticed that kids start attending the classes more regularly. So why is that? Okay? That could just be that they are attracting different types of kids, so households that are kind of more committed to educating their kids. It might be that the price of these classes is a signal of quality, right? So higher price means that you think that it's a more sort of valuable service that you're getting. Or sort of something I find sort of most interesting, it might be kind of a commitment device. So you might actually pay for the class. Once you've paid for the class, that induces you to go afterwards. So you don't want to kind of, if it was free, then you kind of don't care. But if you've paid for it, it makes you think that you want to kind of continue going, even though it might be something that you wouldn't normally do. And in economics, that's kind of called or in the behavioral literature, that's called a sunk cost effect. So after paying for the class, the cost is sunk, so it shouldn't affect your decision to send your kid, but it might. Okay? So these are all things that we're looking at in terms of attendance, and we want to also know whether parents actually know whether their kids are going to benefit and that causes them to pay more. So the classes are supposed to help their kids in school. Hopefully they do. Okay? And if they do, is it that the parents can kind of perceive that, and are they willing to pay more for the classes? So these are all things that I have basically zero answers to right now, but I'm kind of starting to work on. Okay? And that's it.
Okay, we have about 20 minutes for questions. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I have one comment, and what Dr. Barry said about paying for classes and being more committed is sort of the opposite of what Dr. O'Donnell said with gym membership. So that just came to mind. The other thing, basically, is my question. In the United States, we have similar situations with low-income families as far as economics and health care. I'm a retired teacher in alternative ed, and unfortunately, a very severe problem in the U.S. Is anyone in the department addressing these same issues in the U.S.?
So I think for the first question, I was actually thinking about that issue a little bit as I was kind of making these slides. And I think in terms of thinking about, you know, whether people are actually, the question is really whether people are overpaying for these classes, whether they're paying for them and then not using them, right? That's the kind of gym membership example. And that might be going on, but these are basically two different kinds of effects. And I think we could probably even test for them. What usually happens in these classes, if you look at the data, people stop paying kind of before they stop attending. So
you know, once they start getting chased about paying, then they kind of drop out. So it's not as enforceable as a gym membership. So that might not be as sort of big an issue. In terms of thinking about whether people are doing these issues in the U.S., I mean that's something that there's a lot of people in the department and in the economics field. The graduate field of economics is very large. I think there's 100 or so economists in the graduate field that kind of advise grad students across all the different units. And there's a large number of economists who actually work on, I mean, the biggest group is probably in education. There's also quite a few who work on health, like health behaviors and healthcare and those kind of issues. Those aren't things that I work on myself, but it's actually quite a strong area for Cornell economists in general.
Yeah, when you talk about the importance about literacy classes for the moms and for the children, we in this room and campus course intuitively know that more education equals a better chance at a better life and we all value education, right? My question is, do you have any evidence or have you looked at how they value, if they value education, and if not, how they value it? In other words, what's their incentive for their attending classes or sending their kids to school?
Yeah. That's actually an area that I'm actively working on. I think there are a couple of issues. One is, even in the U.S., we don't know exactly what the benefits of education are. They're very hard to quantify, extremely hard to quantify. I think that we all know they exist, but knowing sort of exactly what they are is very hard. In developing countries, it's the same. Conditional on that, there's a few things you can do to just think about whether people just perceive benefits at all or perceive benefits that are kind of in the ballpark of what we think are the benefits of education, which in developing countries is harder because, say women are less likely to work in developing countries, and trying to understand what the benefit of education for a girl is going to be a little different than a boy and stuff like that. But what we're doing is, you know, we measured kind of people's perceived benefits of education across a bunch of different contexts. I mean, I've worked on it in India. I'm doing a project in the Dominican Republic that's actually measuring these. And it turns out that on average, people's beliefs are pretty accurate about what kind of, at least what salaries are for different sort of levels of education. What's less clear is that there's a huge dispersion, and there's a lot of people who undervalue education or seem to undervalue education. And there's even some people who kind of look like they overvalue education. Why that is very unclear. And that's something that I'm actively working on. I think, you know, it might have to do with kind of just the kind of information that they get.
I was trained in economics, but I was trained in psychology. And I'm curious about the history of that economics. And why it took so long, it seems to me, for behavior and behavioral economics to get accepted by economists. You mentioned the resistance. The stuff you're mentioning, the psychology has been known around for a century, although it kept developing. And the other question is, I'm aware that David Feynman winning the Nobel Prize in economics, he's a social psychologist. And I wondered what connections he had or if he had with psychology.
So, in a former I think the major reason it took so long is, I think economists get a bad rap in the sense of lack of understanding what we do. Economists are not in the business of trying to develop a good model of individuals. Economists primarily are in the business of having a tractable model of individuals that allows us to get decent models of markets, economies, things like that. And so the individual, in some sense, we're just trying to get something that's reasonable, but then we're moving up to a higher level of analysis. So in some sense, a lot of what Dick and Bob were trying to do was to convince economists that I mean, I think a lot of economists, you ask them, would say, well, those assumptions are wrong. But they're mostly just going to be noise. Okay? It's not going to be systematic effects. And it's a little bit convincing them that actually, no, it's going to be systematic effects.
So it was their work to convince economists to listen, and then the next generation's work that convinced economists to sort of demonstrate formally the systematic effects, and that's sort of the history. In terms of connections at Cornell, Cornell has perhaps the best connection anywhere of economists and psychologists. So I spend lots of time talking with the psychologists here. We run joint workshops where we sort of alternate between more econ-oriented talks, more psych-oriented talks, and have a mixed audience. The theme project that George mentioned that I led was also bringing a group of economists and psychologists together to sort of spend the year together. And so this is an area that's active, and we're continuing to try to build upon.
Man in the back.
One of the questions which comes to mind in many of these situations is what sort of economic problems are related to lack of information which one would need to proceed to make an informed choice versus which sorts of behavior truly represent paradoxical or irrational behavior based on psychology, such as whether you state something as being first an opportunity or just simply restate the problem linguistically in an inverse sense, even though it's isomorphic. And classically, there have been many sorts of situations where lack of information has been understood and dealt with long before behavioral economics came into play. Yeah,
that's a very good point. And it's something that is being taken, that economists are looking at more and more carefully. So I think in some level, the early generation of behavioral economics got away, I think, with being a little too loose on ignoring the informational story, I think because it was new. But I mean, the literature has been getting, in some sense, more and more rigorous, more and more careful. There's more and more work trying to say, in some sense, exploring it by saying, if we provide people with certain types of information, does that make the effects go away? And sometimes it does, and you're exactly right. So it's something that's getting thought about more and more.
I'm standing up and I'm talking as loud as I can because one of the problems with economics like myself is we don't plan very well and we don't have microphones. Why? I didn't hear the question. That was why. And Pat, I want to go back. And I've been doing research on this question for years, in the 1970s. Why didn't people adopt new technology? Why didn't they? And it always comes up to the fact that there are at least half a dozen different whys. And you left us with a graph that says, oh, these are these six whys, and then you're stuck. And the point is, the question is, how do you go beyond that and say, which of these six are important? And are you doing research on that, or is that still the why question of behavioral economics, which we were doing in the 70s before we knew it was called behavioral economics?
So I'm sorry if that, what I was trying to say with that last slide of the six things is that's exactly what me and my co-authors and I are currently working on, is trying to think about how we would tease those six things apart to try to say what additional data we would need to see if it's social taxation or if it's present bias or if it's something else. In fact, our list is about another six items. And so that's exactly, in some sense, what that project is about, is trying to get nail into that. I'm sympathetic to what you say, because economists do tend to sort of raise more questions than we answer, I think. But I think we're getting better.
In another field of economics, we see daily the huge disagreement between economists about whether QE, et cetera, is working, if it ever worked, will it work, et cetera. And result, and these are not only among politicians, but among economists as well. We just have totally divergent views. Are there similar issues, in addition to what this gentleman behind you was talking about, that you experience in behavioral and developmental economics?
So there's definitely controversy. I'm not sure it's as large as in some of the sort of bigger things where it's a bit harder to model that. I mean, we're really nailing down on the individual. In some sense, it's possible to get better data. But that said, there's I think, still controversies. One thing that I like about being in the behavioral economics literature is those controversies typically don't devolve into fights. but rather they get into constructive conversations. And people trying to say, you know, I believe this, you believe that, how could we try to figure this out? But I mean, very much we haven't sort of answered a lot of questions. I don't know if you want to add about development.
Well, I mean, I would just say very quickly that you know, the stuff on private provision of education, private provision of services generally in developing countries is very controversial in the policy, from the policy perspective, because you know, by charging people for things, you're basically, you know, eliminating the extremely poor from certain types of service delivery. And whether the extent to which that's a, you know, that actually matters is really important. I mean, it's something that I've, you know, spent a lot of time on. But if you, you know, if you just think about an education, you know, why wouldn't the answer to this, why, you know, you could just reasonably ask, why are you studying private education markets if the thing that you really need to do is improve the government system? I mean, understanding the way the market works here is extremely important.
Then 4 years ago, I was an economics major. You could get by with high school algebra. Recently, a son of mine studied economics at Stanford. I saw his book, and I thought it was calculus with a little economics thrown in it. How quantitative were you going to make the new Cornell economics curriculum?
Can we hold that off until afterwards? Can you ask? Because we, well, I mean, if there's no other questions, but I think there's lots of other questions about the work today.
The short answer is that we're trying to make it a mix of, it does need to be calculus-based, but we also want courses that are purely calculus-based because economics really is both.
We certainly have we're going to have a large number of electives that don't require calculus, as well as a large number that do require that.
I just pointed out to the gentleman in the back that doesn't have a microphone that he's only one person, so you know, obviously. But my question really is about loss avoidance, loss aversion. A, where does that come from in our psychology? And B, do we see an uptick in that when there's a lot of turmoil in the markets?
So that's a very good question. So the question is about loss aversion, which is an idea that sort of following up on what I said about gains and losses traditionally being seen symmetrically. The evidence suggests that maybe people react a lot more to losses than to gains. So a $100 loss feels a lot worse than a $100 gain feels good. So to be honest, I'm not sure sort of what underlying mechanisms sort of drive that. There's interesting new stuff in neuroscience suggesting that the gains and losses, when people experience a gain versus experience a loss, different areas of the brain get activated, but I never quite know how to, you know, fully interpret that. So I don't quite know where to go there. It's actually sort of interesting. The behavioral economics literature has really picked up on loss aversion as something that was thought to be very, very important. I think still feels it's very, very important. In recent years, there's been a little bit of sense of maybe loss aversion isn't as important as we thought, and maybe we should be paying a bit more to sort of what's going on with probabilities, and maybe gains versus losses are actually not about how we feel of gains and losses, but how we interpret probabilities differently in those domains. So it's something that's being explored recently, but that's sort of new. In terms of past experience, it certainly seems we have that past experience changes things. So experiencing recent losses, you know, sometimes make people more upset about more losses.
Any studies that you know of regarding extended unemployment benefits and how they affect either the willingness or the timing of people to take employment?
So, not really my area. I don't know if you know what's up.
I don't know it. Yeah,
the question was any evidence of the impact of extended unemployment benefits and how that impacts decisions.
I don't know enough to speak to that.
Ron Ehrenberg in the ILR used to work on that. He hasn't worked on that since recently. There's a very interesting article on this that's just come out by a guy named Hank Farber at Princeton, who got his master's degree at Cornell.
Going back to what you were saying about the loss aversion as not knowing how it's affected, is the economics department planning to do any individual studies using the MRI machine to see whether or not there are different areas of the brain that are used when being at loss versus gain?
So the question is, as you might know, Cornell has recently acquired an MRI machine, so we can start doing some of this neuro work. And certainly the psychology and human development groups are getting very into that. And the question is people in the economics department going to get involved? So my best guess is, at least initially, we're going to be involved in a little bit more of a consultancy way. So part of the reason, a little bit this is a perspective amongst many economists, including myself, which is, I think in terms of neuroscience work, there's a lot to be done in terms of just understanding what's going on in the brain before we can really start taking that evidence to inform economics too much. Because right now people are trying to, but I think they're basically inventing stories. But at the same time, why I think the consultancy role is important is as they're trying to figure out what's going on in the brain, hopefully they'll be asking the types of questions that economists find interesting. And that's, so I actually am involved talking with like Valerie Rain and others in development.
So to what extent are your studies pushing against culture of the country, the tribe, the family, and I don't think you ever use the word culture, but it must overlay all of these things. And so, to some extent, the mother isn't going to apply for education because the tribe or the family says, no, 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 that's not going to happen, even though it would be very beneficial. So it seems to me that culture is probably not a positive impact on the studies you're going to
do. No, I think that's an excellent point. I think that it's actually probably something that economists are, I would say, might be the worst at in terms of kind of understanding and sort of merging that with the way we analyze things. I mean, the one thing that people talk about with these things is empowerment and thinking about how it shifts the dynamics of decision making in the household. And we do actually see that a little bit. That women, when they get a little bit of education, it doesn't take much. I mean, they learn to write their name and they learn like just very basic, you know, reading. And they start to actually make more decisions for their, you know, education decisions for their kids. And so we can kind of see that on a very kind of narrow scale. But I definitely take your point that broadly the culture, like trying to build that into an economic framework is hard. Something we need to do a better job.
Yes. Doesn't that question kind of raise the question of what the researchers were doing at all since the time we all killed
that kind of Well, but the counter is there a purely cultural explanation, right? So in some sense, I think the key is we you know, economists are looking at how certain types of forces push behavior around. I wouldn't want to claim we're explaining everything. And I think, I mean, Jim's point about the sort of reaction to that question in developing countries, same thing applies in the U.S. And often economists say it's... And you know, they'll start throwing out the, oh, maybe it's driven by some norm, which I think, much like culture, we have no model of that. So we're bad at that.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions. Yes, sir.
Sorry, question. On the behavioral side, how quickly, I mean, are you bringing behavioral insights in this test? How quickly do you run into trouble in having a workable model? Does this mean you're pretty micro-focused? And then just on the development side, have you looked at things like in Brazil, initial cash transfers? So families get cash benefits only if children go to school. It's close to the minute, and then you end up with that kind of incentive structure.
So the first question was about in behavior, like how close are we to having a workable model? I think where we're sort of going is realizing that we can't have a model that has absolutely everything in it. But this isn't new to economics. Economics has always been about, I'm looking at this particular application, what are the things I think are important for that application? That needs to be in my model. Other stuff that influences people in other applications, that doesn't need to be in my model. And behavioral is sort of doing that. But you're right, right now we are very micro-focused. Maybe it's a little bit, but we're still trying to really figure out the implications at the micro level or the market level and policies at the market levels. But there's some initial forays going on in the literature trying to push a bit more towards macro, but it's hard.
So the question on conditional cash transfer is basically this program, a program that that gives some cash amount to a household if their kid enrolls in and attends school for a certain amount of days in a month. And it's hugely popular. It kind of originated in Mexico, but it's kind of expanded all over the world. They have these programs. And you know, it's not something that I study a ton directly. I've studied some effects, some programs of incentives on education behavior. But in terms of the economics, I think it's really interesting because it is incentives. When you think about how people react to incentives, and that's something that people are looking at a lot. I don't think people have really dug into the mechanisms behind these sorts of things enough. But it's something that people are starting to look into. I mean, it's a very effective program. They do get a lot of kids into school. Kids don't tend not to learn a lot when they get to school, partially because the infrastructure of the schools tend not to improve when that happens. But that's something that people are working on from a policy side.
Yes, sir. Did you do any research or have any findings on how family size affects the decisions for education and spending? Whereas if you have like six kids, who do you size the school? Who works on the farm? Or do you have more of a need to do those bonding and bulk things you talked about with the bigger family? Do you have any interesting findings there?
I haven't looked at that directly. I mean, there's a large literature on, I guess it's called this, like sibling rivalry literature and things about looking at, you know, quality versus quantity of kids. I mean, it's the way economists talk about it. But, you know, there is research, there is quite a bit of research on that. I mean, I haven't actually applied it directly to what I'm doing, but yeah, I mean, there does seem to be kind of the way, especially when households have a large number of kids, how to decide, you know, who to educate and who to send to work. And those are actually, you know, it depends on a lot of things. The short answer is it depends on a lot of things, but it matters to the household.
Okay, ma'am, and that's going to be the last question.
So besides the areas of your own research, where do you hope the field goes next, or what do you think the most pressing questions to look into are?
So I think, I mean, where behavioral economics has sort of been moving in the last year, I think very exciting, the question is, we'll see where it goes, is the impact of salience. So there's sort of certain things are salient, certain things aren't. Now, you sort of say that, it's like, yeah, but then the hard part is how do you make any progress on that without being able to say, I see something, that must be salient, which is a very bad way to see. So people are trying to generate, you know, careful ways to think about salience with some initial success, but I mean, I think that's a very exciting area for the next 5 years for people to think about.
Yeah, I mean, for development, you know, I'm very junior, so I don't have a great answer, but I think understanding a little bit and being able to really kind of reconcile the intersection of policy and behavior and using the behavior, trying to model behavior and do it in a rigorous enough way that you can inform policy. And when you go and evaluate policy, it actually works in the way that you've modeled. And having that exact sort of chain of things is not something that we've kind of sorted out as well as I think we should.
Okay, it's 2:00, so we have to stop. But let's thank Matty and Jim for